Hi, Darren, do you want to take the lead or do you want me to start?
Melissa, let me give it a go and see,
okay,
and see what happens. So we're covering chapter 12 tonight, which is the policy of appeasement from 1931 to 1936. And right from the get-go, I decided to change the title for myself. And I thought, well, after what I've read, I thought I'd call it Lining Up the Dominoes or Setting Up the Chessboard. Because although Carol Quigley writes it out, sometimes he'll write out and give us the, not the implication, he'll tell us that there are inner groups and outer groups all involved in a grander scheme and a plan to dominate the world into its own designs. And at the same time, he also tends to write a little bit along the coincidental line of history, in a sense. I almost get the impression that I'm catching him out sometimes in that, but that could just be my impression. So he covers the Japanese assault, he calls it, from 1931 to 1941, the Italian assault, 1934 to 1936, and then he talks about circles and counter-circles and ends up with the Spanish tragedy or the Spanish Civil War. And at the introduction to this chapter, I thought I'd just let quickly talk. I'd like to read a section because he says it so well when he describes the state of the average person living in those times. And I think we can sympathize a lot with those times now. So I'll just start reading it from the bottom of the first page. Quigley writes, "The speed of social change in the 19th century by quickening transportation and communications and by gathering people in amorphous multitudes in the cities had destroyed most of the older social relationships of the average man, and by leaving him emotionally unattached to neighborhood, parish, vocation, or even family, had left him isolated and frustrated. The paths which the society of his ancestors had provided for the expression of their gregarious emotional and intellectual needs were destroyed by the speed of social change and the task of creating new paths for expressing these needs was far beyond the ability of the average man. Thus he was left with his innermost drives unexpressed, willing to follow any charlatan who provided a purpose in life, an emotional stimulus, or a place in a group. The methods of mass propaganda offered by the press and the radio provided the means by which these individuals could be reached and mobilized. The determination of the militarists, landlords, and industrialists to expand their own power and extend their own interests, even to the destruction of society itself, provided the motive. The world depression provided the occasion, the materials, frustrated men in the mass, the methods, mass communication, the instrument, the psychopathic political organization, and the occasion, which is the depression, were all available by 1931. Nevertheless, these men could never have come to power or come within a measurable distance of destroying Western civilization completely if that civilization had not failed in its efforts to protect its own traditions, and if the victors of 1990 had not failed in their efforts to defend themselves." And then I sort of to pause here, and I was just thinking about what he is writing here. What he shows is that within the nation state, there is the ruling oligarchy, the ones who are in the know, but then there are also people high up in the social order who have good motivations. They go with the flow. They look after themselves financially, but they're not pushing some kind of agenda in secrecy with others. So when he writes about the nature of these people in this paragraph here, I get the impression that he's not just speaking about the ordinary poor person at the bottom. He's speaking about people in general, how a hidden group can manage this whole lot. So when he writes this, I also get the impression he's being a bit disingenuous because he knows that the few have actually created and set up the state of mind, and they knew that this would happen with the general populace. So here I find Quigley being a bit disingenuous. And he also says, with the speed of movement and communications, the extraordinary rise in standard of living, all these had extended man's ability to do things without in any way clarifying his ideas as to what was worth doing. Goals were lost completely or were reduced to the most primitive level of obtaining more power and more wealth, but the constant acquisition of power or wealth, like a narcotic, for which the need grows as its use increases without in any way satisfying the user, left man's higher nature unsatisfied. He goes on to say here and further on in the book that a lot of the more backward type countries that were being introduced or exposed to the westernized way of life or Western civilization, for whatever that is, was very, very difficult to end. These people were resisting it. But at the same time, the people who were in the West were finding themselves losing faith in their own system. I think this part of what Quigley's written here parallels to our time now, because we are just before another huge shift, as you know, with the Great Reset. People are feeling listless and aimless. They are feeling that their vocation will no longer be necessary in the future. They hear people saying there'll be lots of useless humans, and what will we do with them, and will we just be put onto like a stipend and live our lives without any sort of, without being able to steer our own fate. A lot of people are feeling a bit lost and worrying. So when this kind of situation happens, there are those people in power who will take advantage of these listless, aimless people to rev them up and steer their direction to what they've got next in line. And the Spanish Civil War, I would like to call it the Spanish Great Reset, or the reprogramming of the Spanish state, because, you know, the Spanish seem to be so far behind that I think that they were steering Spain and trying to get it to catch up a few steps and to speed it along to bring it in line with the rest of Western Europe, which we'll get to. So the 20th century reaped where these had sown, with its tradition abandoned and only its techniques maintained. Western civilization by the middle of the 20th century reached a point where the chief question was, can it survive? You can't live a happy, productive life if you're thinking like that. So against this background, the aggressive powers rose after 1931 to challenge Western civilization, and the satisfied powers, which had neither the will nor the desire to defend it. I think that's it's the part that I like to bring out the most, because it's the human element. And it's the part that we can relate to, and we can identify it with the last 10, 20 years of our lives. Okay, then he starts with the Japanese assault. Melissa, would you like to cover a little bit of this section?
Yes, sure, I will do that. I just wanted to, you covered everything that I was thinking was important in the introduction. There was just one little thing. I made a brief note there when you were reading about the speed of social change. What my notes after reading that was, the three things that Quigley hit on was that they were recruiting militarily from the dregs of society. That was his word. The speed of social change and the use of mass propaganda. And I thought Well, those are all of the techniques that are still being used today. This is just technique then that we're looking at. The Japanese assault, 1931 to 1941. Oh, one other thing on the introduction, which Britain factors in throughout all of these, this whole policy of appeasement section. At the very end there, he writes that German documents that were captured since 1944 make it quite evident that Germany could not have made aggression. They could not have been aggressive without help from the, he calls them, satisfied powers, especially Britain. And Britain's role in the lead up to World War II cannot be understated. So we'll get back to that a little bit later, but I'll just read a bit of the very beginning. First of all, he calls Japan a have-not nation. He said it lacked much of the necessary basic materials such as coal, iron, petroleum, alloy minerals, water power, or even food. In comparison, Germany's claim to be a have-not nation was merely a propaganda device. Other than this, the similarity of the two countries was striking. Each had a completely cartelized industry, a militaristic tradition, a hard-working population which respected authority and loved order, a national obsession with its own unique value, and a resentment at the rest of the world for failure to recognize this, and a constitutional structure in which a facade of parliamentary constitutionalism barely concealed the reality of power wielded by an alliance of army, landlords, and industry. The fact that the Japanese Constitution of 1889 was copied from the Constitution of Bismarck goes far to explain this last similarity. I think it's interesting, that point that he makes about Germany's claim to be a have-not nation being propaganda, because if you look at the policy of appeasement, so the policy of appeasement is making political or territorial concessions to the aggressor or the aggressor powers so that you can avoid conflict. And when you see what Britain did there, and part of this strategy or the policy of appeasement was to say, oh dear, we made a mistake with the Treaty of Versailles and we've punished Germany too much and we need to make all of these concessions. And I think that this was mostly strategy by the elite, the round table groups and so forth in Britain, but it definitely, that propaganda was used on the British people. So it's an interesting point there. But moving on, one of the interesting things that he writes about was how in Japan, the military actually was a state within a state. And we're going to see some similarities there to the way that the military was organized in Spain. But there weren't really controls on it. And this complete autonomy of the Japanese military is important. It's going to be important. Now, another interesting thing in the organization of Japan was what they called the Zaibatsu. Let's see if I can find that here. Okay, so there were eight great economic complexes controlled as family units known as zaibatsu. These eight controlled 75% of the nation's corporate wealth by 1930 and were headed by Mitsui, which had 15% of all corporate capital in the country. They engaged in openly corrupt relationships with Japanese politicians and less frequently with Japanese militarists. They usually cooperated with each other. For example, in 1927, the efforts of Mitsui and Mitsubishi to smash a smaller competitor, Suzuki Company of Kobe, precipitated a financial panic which closed most of the banks in Japan. While the Showa Bank, operated jointly by the Zaibatsu, took over many smaller corporations and banks which failed in the crisis, and over 180,000 depositors lost their savings, the cabinet of the militarist General Tanaka granted 1,500 million yen to save the Zaibatsu themselves from the consequences of their greed. Between the military and these tightly controlled family units, we're looking at the main way in which Japanese society was organized. Now, after the war, these units, this is just going ahead here, and quickly doesn't cover this in the book, but I found it interesting. The Zaibatsu were broken up, so essentially they were taken away from families, but still allowed to function in much the same way. So you'll notice that Mitsubishi, Mitsui, these are still companies that are on the go. Another one that he mentioned, or that he may not have mentioned, was Sumitomo. These are all still major companies in Japan. It said that there was a fourth family, the Yasuda, and just having nothing to do with nothing, Yoko Ono is the great-granddaughter of the head of that Zaibatsu. So an interesting thing that comes out of this period of time is the philosopher Sun Yat-sen and the starting of his party, or his, I guess party is the best way of saying it, the Kuomintang. That is an interesting thing. I don't think we have time to get to cover all of the scope of that, but Quigley writes that the ideals were a mixture of Western, native Chinese, and Bolshevik Russian factors. They sought to achieve a unified, independent China with a democratic government and a mixed, cooperative, socialistic, individualistic economic system. In general, Dr. Sun went to China's own traditions for his cultural ideas, to Western, largely Anglo-American traditions for his political ideas, and to a mixture with strong socialist elements for his economic ideas. What you can't say, even how this ended up, the power struggle that finally happened as to Chiang Kai-shek and then Mao, you can't say that Sun's ideas were pure communism. And there was a second place, I don't have it marked here, where I think that the way that Quigley describes it is that the Kuomintang ideals were really a pivot to the West. And I recall when some years ago, something that Alan and I were watching, he made the comment that had it been on the agenda, it would have been so easy for the Western nations to support the Kuomintang and Chiang Kai-shek. That the outcome in terms of global politics would have been much preferable had it gone that way. But he said that that clearly wasn't on the books. So that's kind of interesting, because there are problems with Western ideology, to be sure, but we can see where communism took us and, you know, you could say where it's still going. So,
Melissa?
Yes?
Do you mind if I add something there?
Go ahead.
I just wanted to bring in and jump across to Spain and then back to Japan again. When you look at the stages that the various countries are going through, and you look at what the Russian communist advisors had to say to the government of Spain, and to the rebel government of Spain was that, look, you can't force the Spanish society to adopt all these new changes unless they go through a bourgeois economy that builds up to higher levels of industry and commerce, which then becomes a technological society. You can't jump stages. And it was ironic because the Russian advisors, the communist Russian advisors, were actually, they were neither going to take sides with the Spanish right or left. They were actually more opposed to the leftists and the young socialists in Spain at the time, because they wanted to jump the gun. So there's definitely a international body, whether it be communist or the roundtable groups. They got the same idea that a country has to follow established steps. And so we see that you've just brought up here with Japan. It's the same thing. There's an overarching dominant body that's overseeing things. And they could have taken that shortcut, as you mentioned, with regards to what Alan said. But no, they have to go through all these steps. And they have to take each country through these steps. So Spain was far behind. They were still sort of stuck in feudalized old European times. So all the old European countries were at that. They ran their countries much the same way back in a certain time. Japan was ahead, and then the West themselves were going through a change. So it's very hard as a person who is in one country to understand that there is an international overlay of control managing the world and taking each country through the steps it needs to go. Because when you are in the West and you see yourself as being advanced and you're seeing a country go through the changes like Spain, all these individual nation states can't sympathize with the other nor understand the other at all. And also what the Russian agents in Spain, what they were saying helps to explain the contradiction that we see in the world with regards to our own left-right politics occurring across the planet, and why Russia seems to be almost becoming westernized, where the West seems to be lurching towards communism or something getting there, you know? And you wonder why you have these strange developments occurring. It's just that an overarching body is guiding everyone along a so-called path of civilization, and they want to get everyone to the same standard model. And I think that might help the person out there to understand their own local political scene, and then they can relate it to other countries in the world. And then they can start stitching together the overarching plan to see how it's all being brought into a standardized model.
Those are good points. Thank you for jumping in there. So the key things that happen here in this section militarily Japan's aggression. I mean, there are a lot of things going on here, but I will start with one of the main events, and that was Japan's military attacking Manchuria. And I stress military there because it's made clear that decisions were made, that the military basically was acting independent of the civil government of Japan. They attack Manchuria in 1931. Chiang Kai-shek is down, I believe, in the south fighting the communists. The communists at this point are the native Chinese communists. Now, they were Moscow trained. So Mao Zedong was Moscow trained, and that is who Chiang Kai-shek was fighting. Let's see here. I'm just going to read a little section. It says, though the Japanese seizure of Manchuria in the autumn of 1931 was an independent action of the Japanese military forces, It had to be condoned by the civilian leaders. The Chinese retaliated by a boycott of Japanese goods, which seriously reduced Japan's exports. To force an end to this boycott, Japan landed forces at Shanghai, that's 1932, and after severe fighting in which much Japanese abuse was inflicted upon Europeans, and because the Europeans were in Shanghai, the Chinese forces were driven from the city and compelled to agree to a termination of the economic boycott against Japan. About the same time, Manchuria was set up as a Japanese protectorate under the rule of Henry Puyi, who had abdicated the Chinese throne in 1912. As early as January 1932, the United States notified all signers of the Nine-Power Treaty of 1922 that it would refuse to accept territorial changes made by force in violation of the Calabrian Pact to outlaw war. An appeal to the League of Nations for support made by China, September 21, 1931, the same day that England went off the gold standard, passed through an interminable series of procedural disputes and finally led to a commission of inquiry under the Earl of Lytton. So what's happening here is that the UK is slow to condemn. That's really key. So I'm just going to, instead of taking us through each action here, I'm going to summarize quickly and then maybe go back to a point. The negotiations that were going on were with Japan to stop aggressing were not successful because they were negotiating with civil government of Japan. And not the militarists. Clearly the militarists were in charge, even though, as quickly said, the civil government had to be aware of what was happening. One thing that was slowing down the negotiations was that the Japanese were just assassinating civil leaders. There were civil leaders being attacked left and right. You see that in France too. In 1937, it said Japan attacked China again. We can come back to that maybe if we have time. And what was happening, he quickly takes us through the strategical, what he believes is the strategical thinking of Japan. They are receiving this boycott from China. They are a have-not. They're stressed for resources. They think that they should go and get them at this point. They're going to get them in the Dutch Indies and Malaya. And so they take themselves down a road of strategic thinking, and their thought is, if we continue down this road, attacking Dutch Indies, going into Malaya, the U.S. is going to come after us. So let's attack the U.S. first. And this is what happened in December of 1941. But what we've subsequently learned, what we know to be true, is that the U.S. government knew about the attack on Pearl Harbor. They knew that the Japanese were planning this in advance, and they left ships in the bay there in Hawaii, in the harbor. That provocation was needed to bring the U.S. into World War II. So there are some things going on here that quickly doesn't, I actually don't know when this knowledge became available to academics, but it's my understanding that it was known that this was no big secret. This was the wink, wink. Yes, we know that the Japanese are coming and the American people are not going to allow us to get into this war unless we have an extreme provocation. And just one other key point here is that when the Japanese attacked China, or maybe it was even right before they attacked them, anyway, in 1936, Chiang Kai-shek was kidnapped and forced to agree to a Kuomintang Communist United Front. So that is a key thing that was going on there. Remember, he was fighting the communists, and they're like, no, our enemy at this time is Japan. So we have to unite and go after our present enemy. We can get back together and start fighting each other again if we need to.
Melissa?
Yes.
Another aspect to Japan wanting to sort of fight its way out of its economic misery was also brought on by the Western powers that understood that Japan was in this problem, and they made it worse by putting the squeeze on Japan, an economic squeeze, one that boycotted their exports, refused to allow Japan to sort of release itself of its burdensome populace. So in a sense, they were watching from a distance, hoping to put Japan into this pressure pot. I think they did it consciously.
I think you're right there. I think that's true. Well, if you would like to take the Italian assault, we can just move on there because there's one really key thing here that struck before we leave Japan and China.
Okay.
You know, Quigley does not write at all about the rape of Nanking, the Japanese attack on the Chinese in Nanking in November of 1937. And, you know, I read that section and then I thought, did I miss something here? And I looked up in the index and he actually doesn't mention it. He mentions Nanking a couple of times, but not in the context of the Japanese attack. And this is actually called one of the worst war crimes of the 20th century. And it is horrific. There were 200,000 Chinese killed in a period of 6 weeks. It's one of those almost like Hutu Tutsi where that you could hear the machetes in the air. I mean, it was horrible. And rapes and all kinds of atrocities. And of course, this was known immediately and investigated right after the war. And the fact that Quigley made no even passing reference to that, I just found, well, interesting. All right.
Should I carry on with the Italian assault?
Yes, carry on with the Italian assault. Thanks.
Okie dokes. So we jump across to the Italian scene, and we have a Benito Mussolini comes to light. He was a very smartly dressed, bald-headed man, and on weekends I can just imagine him with a hairy chest and a gold chain around his neck, enjoying the finer things of life, because he was quite an animated character. It describes him as being truculent, which is, I think it means defiant, and vainglorious, and he had ideas of trying to restore Italy to its former glory back in the days of Rome, and he wanted to, much like Japan, he had a growing population that needed to be fed and clothed, and he also suffered from, or Italy suffered from, a shortage of raw materials, natural resources. It says especially an almost complete lack of coal or oil. So the problem, as in Japan, was intensified by restrictions on the immigration of Italians or the outflow of Italian goods. So it's almost, you know, when they're setting up a World War II, and we know that these world wars are planned decades in advance, I can just see the hidden hand, particularly of the round table groups with what we, if you've read through the book, you know that they want you to create blocks of pressure between various areas to make sure that one country couldn't jump the gates and upset the peace, as they call it. So I could just see them with a game of Risk and a few bottles of whiskey and plotting how to set up the dominoes so that a pressure cooker builds, and then as they knock over the first domino, the strategy for the world falls into place. It goes on to say the important dates in modern Italian history are 1922, 1925, 1927, and above all 1934. So it was 1922 that the fascists came to power. In 1925, the parliamentary system was replaced by a political dictatorship within the 19th century Latin American overtones rather than a 20th century Tertullian character. And you can just, I don't know, I just made a joke here. I just said he's like a macho man, gold chains and hairy chests, lots of medals and funny hats. You can just sort of picture that macho, sort of semi-mafio, vainglorious character at the time, strutting their stuff. And since the economic system remained that of orthodox financial capitalism, in 1927, an orthodox and restrictive stabilization of the lira on the international gold standard led to such depressed economic conditions that Mussolini adopted a much more active foreign policy, or at least he was seeking to create an economic and political entente or political agreement with the three defeated powers of Central Europe, Austria, Hungary, and Bulgaria. In 1934, Italy replaced orthodox economic measures by a totalitarian economy functioning beneath a fraudulent corporate facade. Isn't that the definition of fascism? Italy replaced orthodox economic measures by a totalitarian economy functioning beneath a fraudulent corporate facade, and at the same time shifted its dynamic foreign policy from Central Europe to Africa and the Mediterranean. So quickly has a way of introducing and sort of summarizing what the rest of the chapter is going to say. And then he breaks into the minutia of it all. So what you see with regards to this particular chapter or subchapter is that you've got different alliances who have got a historical relation to one another, who were aligned with older historical powers who still, in a sense, seek to get back that which they lost in World War I. Italy, as one of them, felt that they were done a dirty, that they weren't given their rightful due of the loot after World War I, and that they were looking to get some recognition and some status in the world. There was quite a complicated dynamic between these different groups of countries. So you had something called a little entente. And just to explain, a little entente was a group of countries, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Yugoslavia. And this group, this little entente, were generally supported by France, had a historical alliance with France. So if Mussolini wanted to get together with Austria, Bulgaria, and Hungary, he would be interfering on two fronts, because if he decided to form an alliance, a European alliance in Central Europe with those particular countries, he would be interfering with Germany's ambitions. That would make him anti-German. And if he decided to form an alliance with the little entente, he'd also be seen as being anti-little entente, because there was a friction between these two groups of countries historically. So it goes on to say this was an impossible combination, for the division of Europe into revisionist and anti-revisionist powers made it impossible for Italy to create a new alignment cutting through this line of conflict. By following an anti-little entente and pro-Hungarian policy, Mussolini was anti-French and thus inevitably pro-German, something which Mussolini never was and never wished to be. So it comes out that Mussolini wasn't the brightest boy out there. It took him 7 years, however, to realize the illogic of his position. And I think he was overpowered by too much cologne and fancy living. He insisted that Italy was a dissatisfied power, and because of disappointment over its lack of colonial gains at Versailles in 1919 and the refusal of the League to accede to Tommaso Titone's request for a redistribution of the world's resources in accordance with population needs made in 1920, it is true that Italy's population and raw material problems were acute, but the steps taken by Mussolini offered no hope of alleviating them. All right, I'll skip to the next. So we see now, 1933, Hitler ascends to office. After the advent to office in France of a new conservative coalition government with Jean-Louis Barthou as foreign minister in February 1934, France began to adopt a more active policy against Hitler. This chapter's all about France's efforts to really form an encirclement around France. They were trying to rope in Italy and all the other countries to basically ensure the safety and security of Europe and that of France. Now, through British appeasement, their policy of appeasement, which is very, very sneaky, they arranged matters so that it would look good, and Mussolini's ambitions of expanding and gaining new ground, they decided to direct Mussolini, in a sense, to extend his country's ambitions in Africa. So through French and British foreign policy, they encouraged Mussolini to invade and occupy himself in Ethiopia. Melissa, would you like to jump in?
I think that there are a couple of things. You just touched on that, you know, France was chiefly concerned with its own protection, but it also wanted the rest of Europe to jump in and encircle Germany, you know, make sure that Germany couldn't move in any direction. And so this was something that Mussolini, who claimed that he was anti-German, could have participated in easily, but he was also anti-French. So, like you said, he might not have been the brightest spark out there. So he is allowed to go down and be aggressive towards Ethiopia. And this was very much allowed. It was publicly condemned, but again, it's a feet-dragging, convening panels to discuss what is appropriate and not, and Ethiopia suffered. And traditionally, France had been the strong supporter of Ethiopia and had, I'm not sure that they were actually a protector, but they had definitely looked out for Ethiopia's needs as best they could. But France found itself in a position of being alone. It wasn't getting support in their encircling Germany primarily because the British did not have the same agenda in mind. And so I think there was another key thing that happened in this section, and that was the assassination of Barthou. And I'm gonna see if I can find that here.
Yes, I saw that on page 572. Yeah.
Yes, he was the foreign minister. So in 1934, he began to adapt a more active policy against Hitler. This policy sought to encircle Germany by bringing the Soviet Union and Italy into a revived alignment of France, Poland, the Little Entente, Greece, and Turkey. A Balkan Pact of Romania, Yugoslavia, Greece, and Turkey was concluded as early as February 1934, and French relations with the Little Entente were tightened as a consequence of visits by Barthou to the various capitals. Russia was brought into the League of Nations in September 1934, and a French-Italian agreement was signed in January 1935. A common front against German rearmament, which had been announced in March, was made by France, Italy, and Britain at the Stresa Conference in April 1935, and Germany's action was denounced by the League of Nations the same week. So what then happened because of Barthou's success was that he was assassinated. So both he and King Alexander were assassinated at Marseille, October 1934, and Pierre Laval took Barthou's place and carried out his predecessor's plans, but this is important, Quigley said, although much less effectively. Laval was convinced that Italy could be brought into the anti-German front only if its long-standing grievances and unfulfilled ambitions in Africa could be met. So it was Laval who said, okay, Mussolini, you can have 7% of the stock of the Ababa Railway that ran from the French Somaliland on the Red Sea to the capital of Ethiopia. And there were other territories that basically in this agreement between Laval and Mussolini said, here you go. It's Laval insisted that he had made no agreement which jeopardized Ethiopia's independence or territorial integrity, but he made it equally clear that Italian support against Germany was more important than the integrity of Ethiopia in his eyes. So that was a kind of an important thing that happened, and it does factor in, you know, Ethiopia factors in importantly, because the rest of the world looking on did not like this, they didn't like to see this aggression. Now, I think this is a key part in terms of appeasement policy was what Quigley describes as Britain's dual policy in the appeasement period. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I don't have that marked off to read, but my note said, here is the dual policy. One, they publicly supported collective security and sanctions against Italian aggression. And two, the flip side, they privately negotiated to destroy the League of Nations and yield Ethiopia to Italy. So collective security was the idea of the League of Nations. Here's a group of nations we are going to league together for our collective security. And what we learn in this book is that this was never interesting to Britain.
Yeah, he repeatedly mentions that the public in popular polls were always antagonistic to government policy and weren't even in the know.
Mm-hmm.
So the British establishment would give lip service to the public and to the rest of the world, really, in convoluted pretense. For instance, due to popular British public sentiment and probably world sentiment, the actions of Italy in Ethiopia were completely repugnant and unpopular. And so the British government imposed sanctions upon Italy, but it was all it was just a sham because, you know, it was all in name only. Practically, if Britain had just held back on, I think, 1 or 2 months worth of fuel to Italy, they wouldn't have been able to have done a thing in Ethiopia, and yet, you know, none of those sanctions were imposed. You know, it was just a wink, wink, and they let Italy carry on their activity in Ethiopia. Italy was sending its shipping through the Suez Canal, which was British controlled. They could have done something about it, but they made very weak, limp-wristed excuses to the public, saying, you know, they'd rather have Italy achieve its goals in Ethiopia than to have Italy turn on us. You know, we don't want to risk a war between us and Italy or France and Italy. It was a silly excuse, but that's what they came up with. So I think Ethiopia was used as a pawn to prevent a united front against German rearmament. And the British had a lot to play in that role. And I think Quigley actually mentioned somewhere else, maybe in the last chapter, that it was primarily Britain's role in all of these things. I don't know if you'd like to carry on, Melissa?
I think that at this point we can move into the circles and counter-circles of 1935-1939, because this section of the chapter picks up with the importance of Italy's aggression in Ethiopia, and I'll read just a little bit. It said, Laval's agreement of January 1935 with Mussolini had been intended to bring Italy to the side of France in the face of Germany, a goal which seemed perfectly possible in the light of Mussolini's veto on Hitler's coup in Austria, July 1934. This result would have been achieved if Ethiopia could have been taken by Italy without League action. In that case, Mussolini argued, Africa would have been removed from the sphere of League action, as North America had been in 1919 by the Monroe Doctrine Amendment to the Covenant. And Asia had been in 1931 by failure to take action against Japan. This would have left the League as a purely European organization, according to Mussolini. This view was regarded with favor in France, where the chief, if not the sole role of the League, was to provide security against Germany. This view was completely unacceptable to Britain, which wanted no exclusive European political organization and could not join one herself because of her imperial obligations and her preference for an Atlantic organization. And this is important, you know, because of the blocks, which we're going to get into, the trading blocks and so forth, and also NATO, which came out of World War II. I'm skipping just a little bit here. Because there were sanctions, France lost Italian support against Germany. Because the sanctions were ineffective, France lost the League system of collective security against Germany as well. Thus, France had neither bread nor cake. Worse than that, the Italian involvement in Africa withdrew Italian political power from Central Europe and thus removed the chief force ready to resist the German penetration of Austria. Still worse, the hubbub of the Ethiopian crisis gave Hitler an opportunity to declare the rearmament of Germany and the reestablishment of the German Air Force in March 1935 and to remilitarize the Rhineland on March 7, 1936. So basically that the rearmament, the remilitarization of the Rhineland seems to me to be the key thing that moved Europe towards World War II, because it de facto meant that the Treaty of Versailles, the League of Nations, nobody was paying attention to this anymore. The remilitarization of the Rhineland in violation of the Versailles Treaty and the Locarno Pacts was the most important result of the Ethiopian crisis and the most important event of the period of appeasement. It greatly reduced France's own security and reduced even more the security of France's allies to the east of Germany, because once this zone was fortified, it could not decrease greatly France's ability to come to the aid of Eastern Europe. The remilitarization of the Rhineland was the essential military prerequisite for any movement of Germany eastward against Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, or the Soviet Union. That such a movement was the chief aim of Hitler's policy had been clearly and explicitly stated by him throughout his public life. So there you go. That was just flat out allowed to happen. And go ahead.
Yeah, and here in comes Britain again, you know. France could have intervened militarily if they were allowed to, because the Rhineland wasn't really occupied that much by Germany. France could have made a physical move to prevent the remilitarization of the Rhineland. But they couldn't do it because things were too expensive to do. They were trying to save their currency. And they couldn't make a move because with the agreements that had been made historically, Britain could veto it. And so Britain didn't just refuse. They actively opposed France. And there's a scene here, a violent scene with Flandin on March 11th. Neville Chamberlain rejected sanctions and refused to accept Flandin's argument that if a firm front is maintained by France and England, Germany will yield without war. So Chamberlain, or Neville Chamberlain's refusal to enforce the Locarno Pacts when they fell due, was not his personal policy or anything new. It was the policy of the Conservative Party and had been for years, as early as 1934. Sir Austen Chamberlain had stated publicly that Britain would not use troops to enforce the Rhineland clauses and would use its veto power in the Council of the League to prevent this by others under the Locarno Pacts. And as you say, Melissa, it all pivots around this three-block system that the roundtable groups wanted to bring into place worldwide.
If we want to, I could read just a little section in here that is going to talk about the aims of Britain and the roundtable group. Do we have time for that? Or?
Yes. Yeah. Let's do it.
Says, any analysis of the motivations of Britain in 1938-1939 is bound to be difficult because different people had different motives. Motives changed in the course of time. The motives of the government were clearly not the same as the motives of the people. And in no country has secrecy and anonymity been carried so far or been so well preserved as in Britain. In general, motives become vaguer and less secret as we move our attention from the innermost circles of the government outward. As if we were looking at the layers of an onion, we may discern four points of view. One, the anti-Bolsheviks at the center. Two, the three-block world supporters close to the center. Three, the supporters of appeasement. And four, the peace-at-any-price group in a peripheral position. The anti-Bolsheviks, who were also anti-French, were extremely important from 1919 to 1926, but then decreased to little more than a lunatic fringe, rising again in numbers and influence after 1934 to dominate the real policy of the government in 1939. In the earlier period, the chief figures in this group were Lord Curzon, Lord D'Abernon, and General Smuts. They did what they could to destroy reparations, permit German rearmament, and tear down what they called French militarism. This point of view was supported by the second group. Now remember, the second group is, and this is really important for where we are now, the three-block world, which was known in those days as the Round Table Group and came later to be called somewhat inaccurately the Cliveden Set after the country estate of Lord and Lady Astor. Lord and Lady Astor are important in funding Fabianism, the Fabian Society. So here you have the Fabians, which is a form of, you know, slow-go socialism, being funded by the Astors, and the Roundtable Group saying, we see the world in three blocks. So here they list the people. I'll just mention a few that we're going to know by name already. Lord Lothian, Lord Astor, Lord Brand, Smuts, Lady Astor. Now, Lord Brand was the brother-in-law of Lady Astor, managing director of Lazard Brothers, the international bankers, Lionel Curtis, and then the editor of the Times. This group wielded great influence because it controlled the Rhodes Trust, the Bight Trust, the Times of London, the Observer. So what you're seeing here is that the three-block contingent here has control of the media. The influential and highly anonymous quarterly review known as the Roundtable, which was founded in 1910 with money supplied by Sir Abe Bailey and the Rhodes Trust. That's Cecil Rhodes. We've already, you know, been introduced to him, and with Lothian as editor. And it dominated the Royal Institute of International Affairs called Chatham House, of which Sir Abe Bailey and the Astors were the chief financial supporters, while Lionel Curtis was the actual founder. The Carnegie United Kingdom Trust and All Souls College, Oxford. This roundtable group formed the core of three block world supporters and differed from the anti-Bolsheviks like D'Abernon in that they sought to contain the Soviet Union between a German-dominated Europe and an English-speaking bloc rather than to destroy it as the anti-Bolsheviks wanted. Relationships between the two groups were very close and friendly, and some people, like Smuts, were in both. So it goes on page 581 into 582 to talk about the components and the makeup of the roundtable group. But we'll just go out because we're always, you know, circles, counter circles, and circles within circles. Here is the outside circles on page 583. Outside these two groups and much more numerous, but much more remote from the real instruments of government were the appeasers and the peace at any price people. And these were both used by the two inner groups to command public support for their quite different policies. Of the two, the appeasers were much more important than the peace at any price people. The appeasers swallowed the steady propaganda, much of it emanating from Chatham House, the Times, the roundtable groups, or Rhodes Circles, that the Germans had been deceived and brutally treated in 1919. For example, it was under pressure from seven persons, including General Smuts and H.A.L. Fisher, as well as Lord Milner himself, that Lloyd George made his belated demand on June 2, 1919, that the German reparations be reduced and the Rhineland occupation be cut from 15 years to 2. The memorandum from which Lloyd George read these demands was apparently drawn up by Philip Carr, Lord Lothian, while the minutes of the Council of Four, from which we get the record of those demands, was taken down by Sir Maurice Hankey, Secretary to the Supreme Council, a position obtained through Lord Esher. So what you really see here is in this roundtable group, you see long-term strategy, control of the media, and using all of the other groups who think that they're separate and somehow going their own way, basically the appeasers and the peace at any price group. You could just think of as puppets on a string being controlled by the roundtable members.
I made a little note on the side, just a little bit further down. He talks about the British idea of sportsmanlike conduct toward a beaten opponent was built the movement for appeasement. So you could see it was, when they used the word movement, it was an enactment of a long-term strategy. So they were, that term that Noam Chomsky used, manufacturing consent, you could see how they were manufacturing the consent for appeasement. The process is quite interesting. And they based it on the assumption that reparation must be made for Britain's treatment of Germany. If only Germany could meet its demands, its requests for arms equality, remilitarization of the Rhineland, and perhaps union with Austria were met, Germany would become satisfied and peaceful. And they, for 10 years, got the British public to support that.
Yes, interesting. Do we have other things to cover in this section, or shall we get right into the Spanish tragedy?
I think the Spanish tragedy would be I think we've covered everything that we need to, and the Spanish tragedy would be great. Let's jump in.
Okay.
Okay.
Are you jumping or am I?
I'll try. Let me see if I can get things going. The way I have been seeing this whole chapter is that it's all pre-planned. This entire crisis leading up to World War II. It all falls so neatly into the British establishment's or the Anglo-American establishment's hand. All the chess pieces are lined up. And when I take a look at the Spanish tragedy, the way that quickly describes Spain, I could only see the Spanish Civil War as a fast track to updating their software. I call it the Spanish software update or the Spanish reset or the reprogramming of Spain. Because they want to create bigger blocks and they need everyone to be on board. Sorry, Melissa, you were going to say?
I was, yeah. I'll just jump in here. There was the Spanish Civil War is something that whenever I've read about it or watched something or thought about it, I have had great confusion as to what was going on and why. And this little section helped me understand it a little bit better. And I, too, had the same thought that you did, that it was some kind of a reset. But at the beginning of this section, I think Quigley makes a good point here. He said the historical past of Spain has been so different from that of the rest of Western civilization that it sometimes seems doubtful if it should be regarded as part of Western civilization. This difference is increased by the fact that since the late 15th century, Spain has refused to share in the experiences of Western civilization, and if many powerful groups could have had their wish, would have remained in its 15th or 16th century condition. And it goes on to talk about the invasion of the Arabs and their ejection from the country, and Protestantism, they didn't want any part of modern science, the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, etc. And it's an interesting, it's not a deep evaluation of the Spanish mindset. He talks about them being so individualistic as to it being almost impossible to govern. So I think you're right. They had to be one way or the other reset.
Yeah. I just further down, I put a little ND here. It said, I was thinking about Western civilization, and I remember just thinking, well, hang on, what is Western civilization again? And so I went onto the internet, and it doesn't really give you a clear indication of what Western civilization is. I think that quickly just got it right here. He said, where was it? The basic element is moderation. So the basic foundation of Western civilization is its moderation to be found in the real tradition of the West. As ideological intolerance or totalitarian authoritarianism, for example, grew in the West, was bound to have an adverse effect on efforts to carry. So in the past, the peasants, the disenfranchised of the Western areas, they fought for their rights to be seen as equals or as equal as they could possibly get it in pushing back against the church and the state and the nobility. And, when Quigley first started his first opening chapters in Tragedy and Hope, he speaks about how the West was sort of, you had upward mobility. People from the lower classes could enter into the middle and upper classes, and there was a tolerance. So what he's saying is that with the Spanish mindset, they were so set back because of having almost 1,000 years of repression that it had developed into a mindset that was the opposite of what was needed to bring them up to speed with current Western civilization. And so there were a lot of competing groups that were still stuck in the old model of sort of feudal Europe, where the church would be sort of in bed with the king, and they would keep the peasants down. So everyone was deeply suspicious of the other. And
I'll just pop in. There was one other little element that he touched on a little bit, but I thought about more because it's still on the go today. And these are the separatists, the Basque and the Catalonian separatists. This is still ongoing. So what you and I don't claim to be an expert on Spain or their history or anything else, but it is interesting. Another interesting piece here is that he said that the Spanish were strongly Catholic. They had no interest in the Protestant Reformation, Luther, any of that. That just went right by them. They were traditionally and strongly Catholic, and yet the common man hated the church.
Yeah.
This is he said that, you know, they'd have their baptism and then their final unction on their deathbed, and that was it. And he said they had this love of burning down Catholic churches, and this was just the people. So it is true. I mean, it is a very odd dynamic that somehow.
Sorry, but let's carry on.
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to highlight a little thing in my mind going towards the end of the Spanish tragedy is it Alfonso the 13th, when he is, he's in France, he's left the country, he's escaped, and now he's setting up a belligerent force to retake the country. It's what I'm getting from, I'm trying to find it, but you know, he has spent a lot of time out the country, and where was it? He had already set things up like a decade in advance almost. So it's almost like he was part of a greater plan to get all this frustration that had built up within Spain, to get a civil war underway, get everyone at each other's throats, and then, you know, the rest of Europe really made a pretense of being on the side of the Madrid government, but meanwhile they were overwhelmingly lending their support to the king, to Alfonso the 13th and General Franco. That doesn't just happen by chance. So I think that old Alfonso and the coalition of those on the right had planned a civil war a long time in advance, and I'm thinking conspiratorially, but that's what Tragedy and Hope is all about. It shows the greater extenuating mind behind so-called local events. So sorry, I've done a great big skip around, but if you read through quickly and you go through all the points, it can be quite tedious sometimes, and it can tie you up in knots, especially if you're trying to present it to others. And he takes you back and forth, and he shows you how the government switches hands from a coalition of the left, then to the center, then to the right, and then back to the left, and how they were trying to introduce a modern republic, a modern country with civil liberties and all the rest. But they couldn't get it right because of the mindset of the Spanish and the competing interest groups. In a way, they had to knock down these competing interest groups within Spain. And they found, you know, the way to get it done is through civil war. They arranged a civil war. Was it 400,000 Spaniards died at the end of the day? And you could see how Britain in particular coldly and coolly made sure that this happened. How they enabled General Franco to fly in from Morocco. How You know, the Italians supplied aeroplanes, which they crudely tried to disguise as hiding them that they were couldn't be seen as Italian. They had meetings with, the rebels had meetings with Hitler, with Germany, who supplied manpower and troops. And the British made sure that they interfered along the way to make sure that Spain, they did it so cleverly because they used the League of Nations and they made it look like they were supporting the government of Spain. That's the appearance that they gave. But they were essentially enabling in a passive way the rebels to pound the living daylights out of the Spanish government. And they managed to do it and come out of all of it smelling of sunshine and roses. So I have to doff my hat at the Anglo-American establishment. They are sensational and very, very good at what they do. I don't know, Melissa, would you like to go into some of the smaller points leading up to the Spanish War or not?
Yes, there's a couple of things here. I want to back way up to the 1898 defeat of Spain by the U.S., because this was cited by Quigley, not discussed at any length, but cited as being important to positioning Spain for a civil war. The defeat was, you know, humiliating, et cetera, et cetera. There were some goings on in Cuba, and the U.S. sent a ship down there to just be a presence, right? It's supposedly not an aggressive act. It's just going to be a presence, and that was the USS Maine. And there was an explosion in the harbor there in Cuba on the ship, and there was a significant loss of life. And what is interesting, because remember, you know, you can call them false flags or what, you know, deciding moments. You've got Pearl Harbor. This was that deciding moment that brought by popular support, then the average U.S. citizen was, they can't do this. This is wrong. And so they supported this war. And what is interesting to me is that there have been multiple forensic investigations about the explosion. At the time, it could not be determined if the explosion was exterior to the ship or in the interior. And several forensic investigations through the last 100-plus years have not been able to answer that question definitively. Was the explosion on the inside or external to it? But at any rate, the president who sent the ship down there was assassinated about 4 years after that, I think maybe 1902. That was McKinley. And it was said that he was assassinated by a crazed, lunatic Polish-American anarchist who was just following the – inspired by Emma Goldman, who – I think said she knew him, but wasn't involved in it. He acted alone. So we really don't know. We'll never know what was behind the U.S. going to war with Spain in 1898. I mean, we just won't. We can read a lot of things and we can say, and, you know, people might say that they know, but I'll certainly not want to be one of those. So,
but they present a justification so neatly, just out of the blue, you know.
And, oh, absolutely.
Just has to go and, yeah.
So for me, that this might be helpful for other people, but once we get into the Civil War, you've got three groups at play. You've got the Republicans, the Monarchists, and the Nationalists. And without covering all of this in too much detail, basically you had a monarchy system in Spain, as most of the rest of the world had at one point or another. And it was corrupt. And at the time of that it ended, it was Alfonso, I don't remember what number he was, but Alfonso was just kind of inept. And you had all of the different forces. You've got a corrupt military that are overpaid and inefficient. I think they said there were something like 250. There was a general for every 250 enlisted men. The money spent on the military was just crazy. And then you've got the landlords. And what Quigley writes about the landlords is that they weren't really interested in farming. They were interested in playing the tables in the south of France, you know, gambling. And it said that at this point, only 60% of the arable land in Spain was not being farmed. And the peasants who worked the land weren't being paid properly. So that's the backdrop for this. You've got poor people, a corrupt church, a corrupt military, and an inept monarchy. And then within these groups, there are factions. So it quickly divides the monarchists into at least two groups, and he talks about that. They're all interest groups, he says, seeking to utilize Spain for their own power and profit. The threat to their positions following the First World War and the defeats in Morocco led them to support Primo de Rivera's dictatorship. So this Rivera is a minor player, but he's a dictator that Alfonso XIII, there's his number, has allowed to run in Spain. All right, so I'm going to read this section here. Realizing the danger to his dynasty from his association with an unpopular dictatorship, Alfonso XIII tried to restore the constitutional government. As a first step, he ordered municipal elections. And basically, when he orders the municipal elections, what we learned was they wanted to keep the status quo to the election. So corruption as corruption always was.
Yeah.
So finally, when this is out of control and the anti-monarchical forces were victorious, he called upon another general for support. General refused. Alfonso fled France. So now it's called Republicans. So this is an important thing. The Republicans are those who succeeded in acting Alfonso. The Republicans once began organizing establishing an ultra-modern unicameral parliamentary government. He goes to say that because there was no middle class, the middle class was weak and ineffective, none of these changes made any difference because there weren't literate people to take advantage of universal suffrage and a different educational system. But what is interesting about this republic, and I won't take you through each step, but the republic lasted 5 years before the Civil War began in 1936. So from 1931 to 1936, you have a republic. But during this time, the nation was ruled by either four or five different coalition governments. And this is key so that you understand that the Republicans were not unified. And Orwell discovered this himself when he went over, as many British citizens did, to volunteer to fight with the Republicans. He almost lost his life and he was incarcerated because the infighting within the Republicans was so strong. And this has been where I've always had a hard time wrapping my head around the Spanish Civil War, because you can't make characterizations of capitalists versus communists. That's just ludicrous considering what we've learned about this. It can't be monarchists against the fascists. Then we get to the final group, which are the nationalists, and we call them the the fascists, because Franco was right-leaning and ultimately prevailed. But this didn't seem to be about anything except for external forces and other countries' involvement, because we don't have the time to get into this. But the involvement of other countries in funding the nationalists, different set of countries funding the Republicans, the infighting between the Republicans themselves and even the so-called nationalists, this is, it's almost impossible to follow the thread.
Melissa, just getting back to the poor old bourgeoisie, you know, they were a small group in a sort of primitive country. And as Quigley points out, they were sort of torn in two themselves as they realized, as opposed to the rest of Europe who managed to push back against the oligarchy, you know, they didn't realize, in a sense, that they themselves needed to push back against the establishment before the little man, before the proles could get a chance. What you had was a very corrupt group of people at the top, with a small little middle class, and then a huge discontented proletariat. And at the end of the day, the poor old proles were absolutely crushed. And once again, I did mention it before, but just to state here, strangely though, the only defenders of these bourgeois found outside their own group was in the small but well-organized body of Stalinist communists, whose ideological preconceptions of the natural course of social development were so strong that they insisted that Spain must pass through a period of bourgeois liberal capitalism and industrialization before it would be ripe for the later stage of totalitarian communism. And, you know, the roundtable groups, the British establishment and the German establishment, they educated and enabled the educated and educated and housed the Fabians socialists who gave birth to the more sort of active wing of socialism. They sent communists into Russia and into China. They set up communism in the East. And they ran Russia through its paces. But Spain, being on the western side of Europe, I suppose they had to do things a little differently. So it's very interesting to see that the hardened communist group of Stalinists took sides and realized that, you know, you had to grow the bourgeoisie, you had to create a modern European industrial state. And that sort of cuts through all the confusion, because you must realize that these communists were really one and the same with the British establishment. They just went by different names, as you were saying earlier. So there is a global internationalist agenda and plan. And on the higher levels, there's no contradiction. But as you observe history at the stone face, it's horribly confusing. But you get these little hints thrown in like this by Quigley, which makes it quite clear. And then I wouldn't, I'd say that you can extrapolate this, the principle of this, into what you see right now, particularly with the American election coming up. It helps you to sort of make sense of it more.
I agree. So, in sum here, I think that, again, in this section here, Britain was neither fair nor neutral. It placed no restrictions on the war materials that got into Spain via Portugal. It had high-level members of the government and the media participating in on both sides, both in arming, supporting and propagandizing. So it's very fascinating.
I had a thought here. It was that the British establishment were using the various groups, like they were using the Italians to sort of shift themselves out of Europe's, so that they could build Germany up. And I'm trying to find it here, but the League of Nations, the United Nations, I could see how they used the League as well. I think that I just wanted to point out again, because Quigley has brought it up a few times, that there are circles within circles. There's an outer circle of the United Nations that consists of true believers. I think that the inner circles, as you can see how they exploited the peace at all costs people, I think they exploit the League of Nations as well. I'm trying to find the example, but I think the way things are going tonight, I'm not going to succeed. Anyway.
Well, shall we see if there is anyone who has been listening that wants to make a comment or...
Yeah.
So hello, people who are participating. Do you want to comment, anyone?
How you doing, folks? Thank you very much, both of you, for terrific coverage there, terrific summarization of that chapter. I have to say that I would be in absolute full agreement with what Darren stated there at the top end of the presentation. I can think of two words to apply to our good friends, the Brits. Master manipulators, no doubt about it, master manipulators. In relation to Spain, terrible, terrible tragedy. Oh, it was a shocking tragedy, that war. Tore the country apart. And to think that there were people literally pouring in to fight on this, that, or the other side from all around the world in that particular terrible theatre of events. So thanks again, folks.
Thanks, Frank.
I just wanted to highlight something here. In the meantime, the monarchist conspiracy was organized by former King Alfonso from abroad as early as May 1931. You know, these things are thought out in you know, that's 5-6 years. And an underground conspiracy was drawn up under the leadership of Antonio Guayo Chechia, I think you say. This last action was taken at a meeting in Paris presided over by Alfonso himself. So I think this was a long-term thing that Spain definitely had to be brought up to speed. And it shows you the mindset of these people. As I remember Alan would say, you know, these people have the sort of mind of an insect. There's no emotion. You know, you just, they're so remote from the rest of humanity that they just shift things around, and one shift of a piece on the chessboard could mean 200,000 lives gone. And they so calmly and coolly direct humanity around to further their own gains. This Carol Quigley just brings that out to me. Any other comments by anyone, questions, while I'm fumbling around?
We'd love to hear a comment if anyone has anything to add. That would be great.
I just want to say you've done well and 100 times better than I would ever be able to do, so don't beat yourself down for your absences for a few seconds.
Thank you, Christine. I'm really struggling this evening. I've got to underline something double here. I just want to read it. By its insistence on enforcing non-intervention against the loyalists, while ignoring the systematic and large-scale evasions of the agreement in behalf of the rebels, Britain was neither fair nor neutral and had to engage in large-scale violations of international law. And it's old duplicitous England. This is their history throughout the history of Europe. They were always steering things from the other side of the channel. Britain refused to permit any restrictions to be placed on war material going to Portugal. It It refused to allow the loyalist Spanish Navy to blockade the seaports held by the rebels and took immediate action against efforts by the Madrid government to interfere with any kind of shipments to rebel areas. While wholesale assaults by the rebels on British and other neutral ships going to loyalist areas drew little more than feeble protests from Britain. It's all a big pretense. By the beginning of 1937, Britain was clearly seeking a rebel victory, and instead of trying to enforce non-intervention or to protect British rights on the seas, was actively supporting the rebel blockade of loyalist Spain. This was clearly evident when the British Navy, after May 1937, began to intercept British ships headed for loyalist ports, and on some pretext or simply by force made them go elsewhere, such as Bordeaux or Gibraltar. They are able to pull off this duplicitous behavior and rewrite or write history so that they come out, you know, smelling so nice. Now, it just mentions the activities of the Germans and the Russians. The Russians, I see they try to finger the Russians. They always try to finger the Russians, but truth be told, even within their own internal documents, they couldn't find much activity of long duration or intensity. There was Russian involvement, but the Russians were quite restricted from getting to Spain. And so I don't know if Quigley mentions whether or not they succeeded in bluffing the public that the Russians or the Red Scare was involved or not. Yeah, it was strictly confidential. Yeah, they couldn't find any sizable number of so-called foreign Reds, in spite of their great desire to do so. After the Battle of Teruel, at which such foreign Reds were supposed to be very active, Franco had to report to Germany that he had found very few among the 14,500 captives taken, that this fact had to be kept strictly confidential. So they probably did try to pull one over on the public with the Red Scare. Yeah, it sort of ends off. The German government in 1936 gave the Czechoslovak leader Edwin Benes documents indicating that various Soviet armies, oh, this is interesting, yes. So the German government gave the Czechoslovak leader Edwin Benes documents indicating that various Soviet army officers were in contact with German army officers. So when Benes sent these documents on to Stalin, they gave rise to a series of purges and treason trials in the Soviet Union, which largely eclipsed the Spanish Civil War and served to put a stop to the major part of the Soviet contribution to the lawless government. I don't think anyone knows that. Have you ever heard that in mainstream history? I've never heard that before.
No, I haven't heard that.
Britain's attitude was so devious that it can hardly be untangled, although the results are clear enough. Also, quickly, when he was referring to Britain's deviousness, he used the words amazing. I noticed that Quigley likes to, when he finds something, they can sort of like, I think these types of characters get a thrill when they pull off a rather large deception over on the public. It's come up a few times. He uses the word amazing. I think, Melissa, and everyone listening, thank you very much. I don't think I have anything further to really add to the chapter.
Well, I want to also say thank you very much. And I agree with Christine that, you know, everybody, you know, you do a really good job. And I think that Carol Quigley's book is very dense. And each page has so much sort of condensed in it that anybody who attempts to analyze this is pretty brave. So well done and thank you. I appreciate learning from it. So thank you.
A pleasure, Fiona. Thank you very much. I tell you what, even when you think that you might have not quite mastered, but that you've become familiar with what you're reading, it can throw you for a complete blank. I lost my train of thought a couple of times tonight, but thank you very much for listening.
Yes, thanks everybody for being here.